Welcome to the new episode of American Hauntings, the podcast dedicated to the history, hauntings, legends, and lore of America's past. The show is hosted and produced by Cody Beck and written and performed by Troy Taylor. That's me. And we are now nearing the end of our fourth season, Haunted New Orleans. If you're tuning into the podcast for the first time, we suggest you start listening to the Haunted New Orleans season with episode 53, which is where this season begins and where we set the stage for the many dark tales ahead. In each episode of the season, we reveal the history, mystery, spirits, scandals, and sins of New Orleans, a city we believe is the most haunted in America. This is the third part of our series within a series, Dead Men Do Tell Tales, and while we've left the vampires behind this time, I think you'll find that we have even worse things hiding under your bed this time around. So get ready for a painful episode of Haunted New Orleans. Vampires, ghosts, monsters, and an assortment of murderers. All of them have roamed the streets of New Orleans at one time or another and have become part of the city's spookiest lore. Well, some of these boogeymen that we'll be talking about tonight, from the Needleman to the Gown Man to Hugging Molly, have sometimes even caused more fear than killers have. And that's largely because they conjured up some very bad memories of the past, especially when it came to the Night Doctors. The Night Doctors came to life in African-American folklore starting during the Reconstruction period after the Civil War. The stories were initially spread by former slave owners who wanted to make black people afraid to leave the plantations after they were set free. Well, legend had it that the doctors, dressed all in white, would ride the highways and back roads at night, abducting African-Americans so they could perform experiments on them. They were taken from their homes and locked up in medical facilities to be dissected, tortured, and killed so that their organs could be harvested. Well, the legends worked. It caused many people to stay behind locked doors at night and to stay off the roads, but tragically, stories of white doctors victimizing black people have roots in some pretty horrific history. During the early 19th century, medical students often had to resort to grave robbing to procure cadavers on which to practice their surgical skills, while African Americans were especially powerless to protect their dead. To make matters worse, doctors and medical students also performed surgeries on living candidates, all of them black. Southern teaching hospitals would only perform live surgeries for medical students on African Americans, and later, it got even worse. In 1932, Alabama's Public Health Service and Tuskegee University launched the Tuskegee Syphilis Study. They took 600 African-American men, 399 of them who already had syphilis, and 201 that did not, and promised them food, free medical care, and burial insurance if they consented to be treated with radical new techniques. Now, I have some advice for you if you're listening. Never participate in a medical study that promises to bury you for free. Bad sign. During the study, investigators wanted to observe the progression of the disease, but only told the participants they were being treated for, quote, bad blood. They never told them they had syphilis or that a new treatment by penicillin was available. They didn't give them anything. The Tuskegee scientists wanted to see what would happen to the men with no medicine or knowledge about their illness. The study, now known as the most infamous medical study in American history, continued until 1972. When the plug was finally pulled after a leak to the press. Numerous participants died of syphilis, 40 of their wives contracted the disease, and 19 children were born with congenital defects because of it. It seems that African Americans had a very good reason to fear the Night Doctors, after all. Well, New Orleans had its own version of the Night Doctors, except they were called Needlemen in the city. The basics of the story were the same. The needlemen were medical students out looking for bodies to work on. They would stick people with needles filled with a mysterious deadly poison so they could take the bodies back to Charity Hospital for student doctors to dissect. Well, fear of the needlemen spread through the city. It was believed that even a mere brush with someone on the street could cause the victim to have seizures, slip into a coma, or even die. Well, it's possible that the Needlemen were not just the product of hysteria, as many people claimed. In 1924, there was a Needleman scare in Carrollton. It was reported that men were sneaking about on dark streets, hiding behind trees and in vacant lots, waiting to jump out, stick women with needles, and then flee the scene. Skeptics believed that the Needlemen were simply the products of too much prohibition booze, but women in the area swore the attacks were real. Well, in the 1930s, the Needlemen returned again, this time stabbing young women while they were seated in movie theaters. The stories claim that many of the young girls were knocked unconscious by whatever poison the fiends had filled their needles with. The young women were then carried off to, quote, a fate worse than death. For months in downtown theaters, women were screaming and fainting as they cried that they'd been stuck with a needle. Well, the stories of the Needlemen eventually faded away, but during the time when New Orleans was gripped by panic, the accounts were very real to those who were afraid to walk the streets or to sit in a movie theater after dark. In addition to the Needlemen, there was also the Gown Man, a figure that struck terror into the hearts of African Americans in New Orleans for many years. The Gown Man was described as being very tall and thin, wearing a black cap and a black gown that dragged along the ground. Even though this boogeyman would often appear driving a long black automobile, many of those who encountered him believed he was a ghost. Around the neighborhoods where he was usually seen, the Gown Man was known to drop from trees and cause his victims to run screaming for their lives. In the late 1890s, a similar character prowled New Orleans. This creature was known as the Hugging Molly. Wearing a white robe, it would hide in the bushes along darkened streets, and when a young woman came along, it would jump out and scoop her up into a tight embrace. After hugging her for only a few moments, it would vanish back into the shadows and leave the girl terrified, yet unharmed. Even though the Hugging Molly's intentions seemed harmless, the town was soon completely unnerved about a chance encounter with this monster. To African Americans, the white robe that it wore dredged up not too distant memories of the robes worn by the Ku Klux Klan. The Klan had started out as former slave owners who dressed as ghosts and preyed on free African Americans during Reconstruction. Well, eventually, the hugs stopped, and a year later, the mystery of the creature was finally solved by the death of a disabled man who had been beloved by the neighborhood. In his room, his caretakers discovered the white costume that had been worn by the Hugging Molly. The man had only wanted a hug and had been too shy to ask for one. Now, not all of the stories had such happy endings. Around 1930, the Domino Man began haunting the streets of the Gentee neighborhood. In those days, the middle-class neighborhood located around Lake Pontchartrain and Bayou St. John was sparsely populated with many empty lots, patches of woods, and heavy brush. Children who used the secluded paths through the woods to get to school began being frightened by a man in a white robe and hood who would jump down from tree branches and chase after them with his hands waving wildly over his head. They called him the Domino Man because his costume appeared to be made from sugar bags, like those used at the Domino Sugar Refinery, which was on the other side of the Lower Ninth Ward along the river. Angry parents searched the woods for the man. Several people shot at him and a few claimed to hit him, but the Domino Man always disappeared. He'd return the next day, though, apparently unharmed, back to scaring kids again, which was apparently the only mission he had. He never physically attacked them or even followed them very far. He would simply jump out of them, and when they screamed and ran away, he vanished. Well, like the rest of New Orleans' phantom attackers, the mystery of the Domino Man was never solved. Suggestions about his identity ranged from a ghost to a monkey in a costume to a man who just dressed up as a practical joke, which was a pretty dangerous joke based on how many people tried to shoot him. Well, one day he just vanished and was never seen again. Now, these weren't the only mysterious figures that wreaked havoc in New Orleans in the early 20th century, but we're saving the greatest boogeyman in the city's history for the last episode of this season. In our last episode, we talked about the real-life vampires of New Orleans. They don't actually drink blood. Okay, well, actually, some of them do. But there's no question that the lifeblood of the city is tourism. See what I did there? As you can imagine, even though New Orleans embraces its dark side, there are some elements to it that can certainly cause the, quote, family-friendly crowd to choose another place to visit on their summer vacation. A perfect example of what I mean by that took place at the Chateau Lemoyne Hotel in the French Quarter in 1998. On March 24th of that year, a housekeeper walked in to clean a guest room and discovered a man's body on the floor, lying face down between two beds. He was naked, except for his socks, and the floor, walls, and bedspreads were spattered with blood. Mingled with the body and the blood were sex toys and bondage devices. Condoms were scattered all over the room. When the police arrived, they were quickly able to determine the cause of death. The man had been stabbed. a lot. Dr. Frank Minyard, the city's longtime coroner, reported, quote, "It was a horrible, horrible scene. There were so many stab wounds, I couldn't count them all. There was blood on the walls, on the bedroom floor, on the bathroom floor, all over the place." And then he added, quote, "It was horrible," again, just to make sure he got the point across. And then the story got even worse after the victim was identified. His name was Ramon Martinez, and he was a Catholic priest. He hadn't always been one, though. When he was 7, he and his family had fled Castro's Cuba and settled in New Orleans. When he was an adult, he had moved to Los Angeles to become an actor. He landed a few small parts and then some roles in television shows like Archie Bunker's Place, Three's Company, Different Strokes, and General Hospital. He became disenchanted with Hollywood, though, after meeting the Catholic Archbishop of Los Angeles, who was also a former actor. Following the Archbishop's advice, he returned to New Orleans, enrolled in the seminary, and in 1989 graduated with a master's degree in divinity and was ordained a priest in the New Orleans Archdiocese. On his last night on earth, Ramon had registered at the hotel under his own name and listed his address as a P.O. box in Port Sulphur, a small town about 50 miles away where he served as the pastor of St. Patrick's Church. At some point that evening, he went out and picked up a French Quarter street hustler named Robert Chidester, which turned out to be a horrible mistake. Robert, in his confession, claimed that he had agreed to oral sex, but when Ramon tried to sodomize him, the young man freaked out. He pulled out a double-edged knife, which he just happened to have on hand, and to defend himself against the priest's attack, he claimed, he stabbed him more than 40 times. Seems hard to believe this could have been in self-defense. Well, Father Ramon's reputation didn't fare well in the wake of his murder. Investigators discovered that he had more than 300 pornographic films and a few hundred skin magazines and books at the rectory. The police did what they could to minimize the damage, though, and news reports failed to mention that he'd been found nude by the housekeeper. They also left out the sex toys, the used condoms, and the 300 movies. Meanwhile, right after the murder, Robert Chidester fled to Cincinnati, where he tried to keep a low profile and failed miserably at it. He crossed the Ohio River into Kentucky and stabbed someone else. But the victim refused to prosecute him, likely a married businessman who had also picked up the hustler, and Robert was released. Then, just to show how smart he really was, he returned to New Orleans, where he hooked up with a tarot card reader. Thinking he could impress her, he told his new girlfriend that he'd recently killed a Catholic priest. Oh, man. And as a token of his love, gave her the knife that he'd used to kill the priest with. Well, the girlfriend was not impressed. First chance she got, she turned him in. On September 24th, 1998, detectives crashed into Robert's flophouse apartment and arrested him. In his confession, he claimed to be the angel of death sent to punish a wicked priest. Even after the arrest, the police were reluctant to mention anything about sex. The commander of the homicide division would only say that Father Ramon and Robert Chidester had argued. Quote, "We do have some idea what they were arguing about," he added, "but it would be inappropriate for me to disclose that at this time." Well, Robert's confession kept the case out of the courts, and the judge sentenced him to 25 years in prison. So yeah, most likely, if he's still alive, he's probably out on the streets again now. So give that some thought the next time you're walking down a dark street in the French Quarter some evening. In 1884, a World's Fair of sorts came to New Orleans. It was called the World's Cotton Exposition, and it brought hundreds of thousands of people for a fair in Audubon Park. Among those who arrived in the city for the event was a Frenchman named Dr. Etienne Duchamp, a dentist who, after arriving in America, embraced a new form of medical treatment called magnetism. Magnetism had all the credibility of other medical sciences, like phrenology. In other words, none at all. But the average person was quick to believe in get-well schemes in those days. Oh, well, I guess not that much has changed when you consider crystals, oils, and magnetic bracelets. But anyway, Duchamp became very successful. He had a home and office at 714 St. Peter Street, and he distributed cards throughout the French Quarter that read, "Let us look for the truth. Let us do good. Let us be magnetized." With his advertising charm, good looks, and boasts about how magnetism could treat any ailment from alcoholism to erectile dysfunction, he built up quite a client base. And to the patients that visited him the most, he revealed even more of the secrets of magnetism. It could give you psychic powers. Duchamp was convinced he could use those powers to find the lost treasure of the pirate Jean Lafitte, which was hidden somewhere in the swamps off the coast where Lafitte and his men once plied their trade. Today, you can go to the same spot and take airboat rides and feed marshmallows to alligators. But the doctor needed help finding the treasure. He needed a medium to act as his go-between with the spirits. The medium needed to be a 12-year-old virgin. Now, he didn't explain what he needed a 12-year-old virgin for, but it was so happened that one of his best customers, Jules Deitch, had a 12-year-old daughter, presumed to be a virgin, and she just happened to be very beautiful. Well, Duchamp suggested that the daughter, Juliette, would be perfect for his plan. Both the girl and her father would become rich beyond their wildest dreams with their share of the treasure. Well, Jules agreed to let his daughter participate in the scheme. I mean, Duchamp was a respected doctor, after all. What could go wrong? In order for Juliette to make contact with the spirit world, the doctor dosed her with large amounts of chloroform for their private mediumistic sessions. Well, this all seemed above board to Jules because, well, obviously he was an idiot. Well, after several psychic sessions, the inevitable happened on January 30th, 1889. As in every other session, the doctor asked Juliette to strip naked and climb into bed. Duchamp also took off his clothes and got into bed with her. Then, as he did each time before, he put a handkerchief over the girl's mouth and nose and dosed her with chloroform. But this time, he didn't have enough in the bottle to put her out. So the doctor dressed and went to the pharmacist to buy more of the drug. Well, Juliet's younger sister, who had witnessed all of this, and I'm probably scarred for life, used his trip to the druggist as a chance to run home. When she arrived back at the doctor's home with her father, they found Juliette and Duchamp in bed, both naked. But this psychic session ended in disaster. Juliette was dead. And the doctor, well, he was nearly dead too. When he realized he'd overdosed the girl, he'd stabbed himself in the chest four times. But his wounds turned out to be superficial. He was taken to Charity Hospital and from there straight on to the parish prison. The coroner had determined that Juliette had died from an overdose and found evidence the girl had been sexually abused over a long period of time, apparently while allegedly communing with the spirit world. While in jail, the doctor was still making grandiose claims about finding Lafitte's treasure if he was released. He also told the authorities they had no right to keep him locked up because he was a scientist and a great man. Well, his wild claims continued at his trial. He protested that by putting him on trial in an English-speaking court was a farce because he only spoke French, which wasn't true. He also claimed that he was incapable of murder because he was a gentleman, also not true, and that the trial was really only an attempt to, quote, smear the good name of France. Well, he was found guilty after the jury deliberated for an entire 18 minutes. He appealed the verdict, got a new trial, and this time was found guilty in 13 minutes. While awaiting his execution, the doctor became even more bizarre. Guards witnessed him having long conversations with the ghosts of Juliette and Jean Lafitte. The authorities were divided as to whether he was insane or just acting insane to avoid execution. When his date with the hangman was finally set, Duchamp protested he didn't want to be hanged next to common prisoners. He was a refined gentleman and doctor, and this was a terrible indignity. Well, the French ambassador even filed a complaint on his behalf with Governor Nichols. But the governor was as thoroughly sick of the doctor as everyone else, and he set a final execution date for May 12th of 1892. Before that could happen, however, a very strange incident occurred. It remains the one unsolved mystery that has lingered with the case. On the morning of April 19th, Judge Robert Marr, who had presided over both of the doctor's trials, had gone to vote in the spring election. He was seen by several people walking along the Mississippi River about an hour later, and then he was never seen again. Judge Marr vanished without a trace that day. No evidence of foul play was ever found, and there was no evidence of suicide. He was simply gone. His body was never found. Well, his connection with the doctor's trial could not be overlooked in the investigation of his disappearance. The judge had been the one who demanded that Duchamp should go to the gallows, and he was adamant about the fact that the doctor was not insane. Duchamp was elated when he heard the news of the judge's disappearance, convinced then he would never hang, but he turned out to be wrong. He went to the gallows on May 12th at 1 in the afternoon, and 20 minutes later, his body was cut down and taken away to a murderer's grave. Even after he disappeared, Judge Marr made sure that Etienne Duchamp was punished for his crime.
Have you ever wanted to learn a new language? And I don't mean like spells or incantations to trap spirits, you weirdos. I mean like a new language that could help you start communicating with more people on this plane today. Then I need to tell you about Rosetta Stone. Look, you know the brand, you know the name. They have the expertise and a 30-year legacy, which makes them more qualified than ever to help you learn a new language today. They've helped millions of people build the fluency and confidence to speak new languages. Now, this is the part where Troy would tell me that I made some kind of grammatical error, but he's not here right now, so like, I don't know, it's like speaking tongues. Rosetta Stone focuses on speaking practice for real-life scenarios to get you ready for real conversations with real people. Or maybe you can even learn how to use some different types of Ouija boards. I don't know. Either way, Rosetta Stone can help you learn faster and retain your new language better. Honestly, Rosetta Stone really would have come in handy for season 4 of New Orleans because I know we butchered some of those French names and I apologize once again. Now, you all know I have a 9-to-5 job when I'm not at the podcast factory, and Rosetta Stone actually helped me not make a total fool out of myself while I was in Brazil interviewing celebrities. Obrigado. And now I want to help you. So don't put off learning that new language. There's no better time than right now to get started. For a very limited time, American Hauntings podcast listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/today. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/today today. Rosetta Stone, how language is learned. Wait, by the way, Troy, like where do words come from? Hey, no, don't walk away. Oh, Troy, where do words...
There's one thing that the American Hauntings podcast knows about, and that's mothers. We featured a lot of great mothers in a lot of our episodes. Pearl Curran, Julia Lemp, Sarah Moore, Marie Laveau, Jane Mansfield, Tamsin Donner, Delphine LaLaurie, Belle Gunness. Okay, maybe leave out those last two. But what I'm saying is that with Mother's Day coming soon, you need a truly special gift for your mom because, well, she's not Belle Gunness. So let me tell you about MyLifeInABook.com. It's a unique service that literally turns your mom's life story into a book. So here's how it works. Every week, MyLifeInABook.com will send your mom a question in her email, the same way she sends you questions about your dating life or when you plan to give her grandkids. Anyway, these can be pre-written questions about her life or any custom questions that you want to ask. She replies by either typing in the answers or by recording her own voice. Then MyLifeInABook.com compiles all her responses into a keepsake book, and they can create an audiobook that uses her voice recordings, preserving her voice and her stories forever. As anyone who doesn't have their mom around anymore can tell you, having your mother's stories about growing up, being a kid, and overcoming life's challenges will be something that you and your kids will treasure. And let's be honest, your mom has given you a lifetime of stories. This is your chance to give her a very cool way to share them. Honestly, I decided to try this out for myself, and I sent it to my mom, and she's not exactly a whiz at computers, but she still found it really easy to use. My mom might have had a little more unusual childhood than a lot of mothers do, so I'm really glad to have this, and I think you'll be glad to give one to your mother, too. So check out MyLifeInABook.com and use the code HAUNTINGS at checkout for 10% off. Create an unforgettable gift for your mom this Mother's Day. That's MyLifeInABook.com and use the code HAUNTINGS for 10% off today. If I take a drink, I can hear it. I can hear, like, you know, dogs barking down the street. And I know you don't hear that stuff. It's just coming through the headphones. But, God, it's weird.
So can you
that's better.
Is it changing stuff?
Yeah, that's better. What?
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 Okay, let me see. All right. You ready?
Sure.
Okay.
Ready when you are.
Thanks for tuning into the American Hauntings Podcast, the show where we discuss history, hauntings, legends, lore, and the dark side of American history. We are now finally nearing the end of season 4 of the podcast, Haunted New Orleans. I'm your co-host, Cody Beck, and with me is my co-host, author, historian, crime buff, and the founder of American Hauntings, Troy Taylor.
Somebody just asked me, how many more episodes do you have in the New Orleans season? And I said, 2.
Are
maybe.
You, yeah, I was going to say, are you sticking with that?
And then she said, well, I don't care. 2, 12, doesn't matter to me. I just was curious. And
that's fair.
I'm going to go out on a limb here, and I'm going to say probably 2.
You feel pretty confident about that.
I do. With the stuff I laid out at the beginning of the season, I kept adding to it and making it. They always grow.
Yeah.
I always have a plan, but then they continue to grow as time mm-hmm. goes on. And I felt pretty good about this one as I added to it. But I think it's gonna be 2 more. And
okay.
It's going to be a new season. And I'm pretty sure what I want the new season to be, as long as you're cool with it.
Yeah. So,
we'll talk about it off the air.
I'm really excited to hear. I know we've tossed around some ideas in the past, but I'm excited.
But this isn't one we tossed around.
Oh, okay.
This is
all
something
right.
different.
All right.
But I think that I think this will work.
The last time you had a random idea, it turned into episode after episode of court cases about axe murders.
I know it did. But so this is another random episode that could be like a 50 episode season.
Sure.
I don't know.
All right.
But we'll see. So
awesome. Okay. Do we want to talk about upcoming events? Do we want to talk about current events? What do we want to talk about? It's a strange day for us right now and a strange place.
It is. We should have been at the conference this weekend. We should not be recording a podcast.
I should have a drink in my hand.
I know. Spoiler alert, you're going to be listening to this on July 7th, but we're actually recording it on June 27th, which was the Saturday of the conference. So that's what we should have been doing, but of course we're not. Although there is a all-day online event going on. In fact, when we finish this recording, we're going to do something live for that. So you will have seen us on the same day we recorded this. But,
and where we're supposed to be right now.
It's kind of a downer. The whole thing's kind of a downer. But we do have stuff coming up. In fact, after you listen to this, the following Saturday, we're going to be doing our next live stream event for those who live too far away to attend in person. We're now deciding that we're not going to talk about how we can't do things because of the pandemic. So we actually are open in Illinois now. We're pretty open, and so we're going to be able to do some of our events. But we are going to keep doing these live stream events. We've done a few now, and people really like them. And we've had a good crowd. It's a nice. In fact, in some ways, it's almost more interactive than the dinner things we do, because people can really one-on-one ask questions at the end and that kind of thing. They've been a lot of fun. But our next one is going to be on July 11th, and it is a live stream with the St. Louis Exorcism.
Fun.
Which is going to be the uncensored version of the story, the one that we do at the dinners, not the one that's in the book or anywhere else that I do this story. This is the uncensored version with lots of information you won't get elsewhere.
Will there be fire alarms?
Yeah. Well, we hope not. That was that was something that happened to us last year. But yeah, let's hope not. But we will... we'll have that, and then on July 31st, we're going to have another one. And as of this recording, I have not announced what that'll be yet. So, but it is going to be an evening with Lizzie Borden.
No,
and
not
that's one. That's one that is a really popular one in person. So we're going to do it online. I've had a lot of requests for it, so we're going to do that one next. But anyway, you could check out the details on those at AmericanHauntings.net on our website. And then, like I said, with Illinois back up and running again, we've just posted all of our tours and events for the fall in Alton. That's walking tours, bus tours, the Ghosts of the River Road tours that Lisa and I do, and all of the evening with dinner events. We've got some favorites and some new ones that we've added to that for the fall. We've got the ghost hunts at the Mineral Springs, that kind of thing. All of that stuff is up now, And we are starting to book stuff, especially the River Road tours are starting to actually fill up, believe it or not.
Nice.
People are looking forward to the fall when, you know, times will be a little bit different.
Right.
So you can check all that out at altonhauntings.com. And of course, we've got our ghost hunts and overnights around the Midwest that we've got for the rest of the summer and the fall. We posted those too. And that's at ghosthunts.net. So yeah, lots of things coming up. Finally, that, you know, we can breathe again. Did I, have you seen that? I don't know if you saw the comments or anything, that we've decided that we're going to call everything before March of 2020. We're going to call that the before times.
The before times?
Yeah, Becky Ray, our friend Becky Ray thought that out.
Yeah, I love Becky Ray.
So she coined that phrase. So we're now calling it the before times.
Okay.
And this is going to be the after times.
The after times.
So we are preparing for the after times for this fall. So it's going to be good.
Wait, when's the cutoff again?
It was the before times was middle of March.
Oh, okay. Because
that's when everything
like
started 13th, to really 14th close.
Or something.
Right. Yeah, the last events we actually did was March, Friday the 13th and the 14th. We had a Brianna and I did a dinner with Spirit World on the 13th. And then Lisa and I did a River Road tour on the 14th. And then that was it. The last things that we've done, other than tons of online stuff, which has been really great. I mean, that's, like I said, and I think we talked about this before, that's been the silver lining to all this stuff, is all this online stuff that we've, I feel like we've really kind of grown the community of people.
Yeah.
You know, in a way that we would not have done in the before times. We might not have grown things the way that we did.
And you reached a wider audience.
Yeah, so now we have, I mean, we're interacting with people that, you know, were names that we saw on, you know, that might comment on something on the Facebook page or something. And now, you know, we're talking to those people all the time. You know, they're interacting with all the events we do, all those Friday night quarantine live streams that we did. It's been pretty cool, actually.
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't know. There's, you know, the whole thing sucks. I mean, the virus and the people that have gotten sick and especially the people that have passed away because of it. But on the other hand, I think that it has done a lot for us as a whole country as far as interacting with each other in a different way. I feel that I've gotten a lot, you know, more interactive with people than I would not have gotten interactive with. And I think it shined a light on some of the things that are wrong with our country in a very strong way that we need to correct and do things differently, say come November, for instance, you know, that kind of thing.
Right.
So I think that that is going to make a big difference, and it's going to be, this is going to be a life-changing event for a lot of people.
Yep.
You know, it's not the, I mean, it's never going to be the flu epidemic. It's not going to be the Spanish flu. That's millions of people dead.
Right.
You know, but it's still going to be a big event we're going to mark in the history books.
Yeah.
The before times
and the after times. I'm just thinking about all the meetings that now I know for a fact could have been emails.
Yeah, exactly. Right? All the time we've wasted doing dumb stuff that we didn't have to do.
That's
been a bonus right there.
Yeah.
You know, and I would think with your work, especially where you guys do so much stuff online, you know, as a company, you know, you guys must have wasted a tremendous amount of time.
Oh, I mean, I think,
but on the other hand, what the hell are you guys doing? You don't have any movies to talk about or anything with cinema. It's cinema blend.
Yeah.
What do you do? Because believe me, I go to Amazon every week and I'm like, seriously, nothing came out this week. There's nothing except for these really bad movies.
So, Troy, we've been leaning real heavily on the blend part of that. And we've been figuring it out. And, you know, we've realized a lot of people, it's like, you know, 20th anniversary of The Matrix or something. So it's like, let's get the, you know, the DP for The Matrix or whatever.
But see,
like,
that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Because I've been
sitting home with nothing to do.
Yeah, I've been seeing a lot of reunion things that have been a lot of fun to watch because nobody has anything else to do.
Yep.
So why not, you know, let's have the reunion of, some of them have been pointless.
Sure.
But I mean, no one cares, you know, but you watch it because it's kind of like, oh, well, this is kind of cool. I watched that show, you know,
exactly.
And it's been kind of neat.
We've been getting creative.
So yeah, that's good. That's well, and see, again, another silver lining. We all have to start looking at something different that we can do. So I'd say that worked out pretty well. So yeah, it's, I don't know. It's been a weird time, but you know, I don't think it's been all bad.
No, definitely hasn't been all bad.
Believe me, there have been weeks where I'm going, I wonder if I'll buy groceries this week.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, Overall, it has forced us. I mean, I wrote two entire books.
I know. What is that?
During this thing. I wrote two entire books during the quarantine because I just had nothing else to do.
Yeah.
Well, when you're not booking any tours or events or anything, I mean, you got a lot of time on your hands. And I was just about to say there's only so much TV and movies that you can watch, but really not for me.
No, not so much.
I don't have an issue with that. I can always find something else to watch. I found so many great, like, foreign, you know, Scandinavian and British
cop shows. Yeah, you've been on
that. Man, I love this stuff. So, and I liked it already, but now I'm just, like, super into it.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking maybe I'm going to take up, you know, like, Icelandic language or something, you know?
Because I
might as well.
That.
What the hell?
Yeah, I can see that.
But I really want to go to Iceland now after watching, like, several different cop shows.
Is that going to be the fifth season? Is, like, ghost stories
of
Iceland?
No. Not if I go there, yes. Then it is going to be for sure. So,
well, there's a couple things I wanted to run through. And honestly, this might just
I need to stop talking about the before times.
The before times. I still, trademark Becky Ray.
Yes.
This might just need
to
be.
We have to pay her a nickel every time we see
I know.
This,
we're already in debt. This might just be a segment I need to introduce that just might be called Before I Forget, because there's some things I'm going to talk about. I want to say thank you to Mark Voorhees, who sent us these candles.
Yes.
With these crazy, what do you call them, inscriptions, carvings on them, and he sent us this really long note about them. And I meant to say thank you last time, but last time was just kind of a shit show, and I ended up forgetting.
Oh, yeah, we did forget about that.
Yeah, we forgot about that. Just want to say thank you, Mark, for that and for everything. Troy, you were also just on the Ghostly Talk podcast, which is our really good friends, whom I would be drinking with right now in this very building. So shout out to Scott and Amber. I was listening to that on the way here, and you should go check out their podcast. It's a really good time.
Yeah. So wait, I should probably give you a
disclaimer.
A disclaimer on that.
Yes.
If you are worried about, you know, if you're one of those people who complained if Cody and I get even slightly, like, not maybe political or at least maybe a little, I get a little
opinionated
about,
like, people
politics
do
or religion.
Do
or
people
anything
do that?
Like that?
Do they get mad at us?
Yeah, we
that?
Try not to do that too much on here. But if you're one of those people who get offended, then don't go listen to Ghostly Talk. But if you don't mind that, if you want to hear what I really think about some things, go listen to the new episode of Ghostly Talk.
Yeah,
or it may not be new by the time everybody hears
I think it's
hears
the latest.
It,
well,
but
yeah,
it'll be
true.
The latest one. It has my name on it.
Yeah,
so
you'll find it.
It's a little different podcast than what Cody and I are doing today.
Yep, so. and I like that. The last thing I want to ask you about: did you have any experience with the? Is it the Whaley House?
Yeah,
in San Diego.
San Diego. Yeah.
Have you been there?
Yeah. Yeah.
Was it cool?
Yeah. Oh yeah.
It's I just cool. heard some fun it's, stories.
Yeah, it is. It is a cool place. I love San Diego anyway, but Old Town is awesome, and that's where the Whaley House is. And it's in it kind of the original part of what was San Diego back when it was settled. And it's a cool location. It's got a cool history behind it. Man, great Mexican restaurants in that part of town, a lot of restaurants and stuff, and a lot of really cool historic buildings. And it's not too far away from, like, the Hotel Del Coronado, is, you know, really great place, very haunted, lots of ghost stories. But yeah, I know the Whaley House pretty well. And, I love San Diego. So
awesome. Somebody was talking about it and I got curious, started reading some stories about it. And I was just kind of wondering. Yeah. Anyway, that is the Before I Forget segment. Who knows if it'll come back, but it might. But let's dive into some listener reviews here. So this first one is from Pooh Bear's iPod. Okay. It's called Love Listening to This Podcast. It says, my fiance and I have attended the Dead of Winter Festival every year since we started dating in early 2018. And the last year we began listening to the podcast and we both just love listening to it.
I think we made people. Remember?
Oh,
that was the year I made
people. Yeah, we forced you
get
to.
Get their phones out.
But I'm so happy we did that, and thank you. So we love history and haunted places, so it is truly the best of both worlds for us. The Limp Family episodes have been our favorite season so far, since the Limp Mansion is one of my favorite places in all of St. Louis. Keep up the great work, and I love the banter between Cody and Troy. It makes me laugh. Oh, that's nice. definitely a 5-star rating from me. Hope to see you at the next Dead of Winter Festival. Savannah, Georgia, and Tybee Island are a couple of our favorite places to visit, and would love to hear a season on the history and haunting of Savannah someday. So thank you very much for that, for, you know, checking out the show and coming to Dead of Winter Festival and everything. This next review is from Young at Heart 75. It's just titled Awesome Podcast. I recently found your podcast. I work in a crime lab in Texas, and with everything that is happening, I'm a one-woman show running an evidence office. Well, I was given permission recently to listen to your podcast, and yours came up as a suggestion because of my interest, of course, you know, is in anything to do with crime and the unknown. Well, I listened to season four and was completely hooked. I love the history and ghost stories that go along with it. Just to let you know, I do listen to the end. Again, awesome podcast. Love it. Keep the stories coming. Well, I'm glad that they're letting you listen to podcasts while you're working.
Speaking of listening to the end.
Yeah.
I want to thank everybody who wrote in about the land shark.
Oh, yes. I have a note in here, episode, too. I watched the video today. That's a good skit.
It's hilarious.
Yeah, I liked it a lot.
And it was. We were right. It was the land shark.
She's like, plumber. Yeah. That was good.
Telegram.
Telegram. Okay. So this last review is from Hagadi Donkeyo. Seriously, one of the best podcasts. I love this podcast. I love the history lessons and the stories that go along with it. From the first episode, I was hooked. Keep them coming. From the first episode,
ooh,
you were
ouch.
Hooked? I mean,
ouch.
I'll take it, but
yeah, that's a
dang.
The Alton season's a low bar.
Yeah, it's,
there.
That's so a little rough.
If you like that one, then it's just all uphill. For, yeah, you're all up from there.
Yeah,
not
there,
uphill.
Yeah,
I
there
guess
you go.
It's all, it's
you
all
won't
good
believe
there,
what happens
so.
Next.
Yeah.
So the okay, are you ready to dive in?
Yeah, sure.
My first note. I started taking notes, and then after a while I was like, wait, are we talking about like cryptids today or because I kind of think that I'll explain.
There's some weird stuff going
there's
on
some weird
episode.
Stuff going here, so
I just couldn't let it go. I had
you
to put this stuff in. I
you
just
couldn't
had to.
Let it go.
No.
It was a lot of like, this is kind of harking back to the last episode of comment I made, but it was a lot of like Spring-Heeled Jack type characters.
Yeah, sure.
And I told my cat today when we were having our normal morning conversation,
our normal meeting,
yeah, we're talking about I said I think today we're talking about mythical figures, sort of loosely based on real life events, but a lot of times seem to be made up to make people behave. And I was like, I went to Catholic school for 9 years, so I've been preparing for this
for
a long time.
Right.
I was really hoping to see Lisa's face when I said that. But anyway, let's dive into some of these bizarre stories that you got going on here. Let's start with the night doctors. She said, legend has it that doctors dressed all in white would abduct African Americans at night to perform experiments on them. And so the stories were initially spread to make free slaves afraid to leave the plantations,
right?
Which totally makes sense. But you said some of these stories have true and horrific roots.
Yeah.
So I knew about grave robbing for medical school and things like that, but I didn't know about live surgeries and stuff for medical students.
Yeah, because when you're talking about someone who's considered legally 3/5 of a person anyway, so they don't, you know, it was a situation of people in the South not being considered to be fully human.
Mm-hmm.
It was okay to operate on them. And yeah, that was, honestly, that's about as the worst thing I've ever heard, as far as racism goes, that I didn't know about already. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's true. And it turned out, and I thought, when I read that, I thought, oh, come on.
Yeah.
Nope, it's true. They would actually perform, say, a burst appendix, and they would perform it live in front of students so that they could see what it was like.
Jeez.
And they didn't do that with white patients.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, only black patients.
And I mean, well, luckily that kind of stuff has stopped because, oh, boy, then there's the Tuskegee syphilis study, which I already knew about this just because.
Yeah, me too. I didn't think I knew it ran until 1972. I did not know that.
And that was my psychological test and measures class where they talked about ethics and things like that. This is always the one they brought up. And I was like, oh, okay, that's a long time ago. But no, like you said, 1972.
Not really. Yeah.
And I mean, they only stopped because they got caught.
Because they got caught.
Right?
We're really sorry. It's like everybody that you see that apologizes for, you know, oh, I'm sorry. Did you see my video from 2001 when I was in blackface? I'm really sorry I did that. Yeah, because someone found it.
Right.
Otherwise, you did it.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's pretty much the same thing.
It is. Moving on to more terrible things. So, the Needlemen. This to me sounds like Slenderman's weird cousin.
It does, doesn't it? Yeah.
And so the basics of the story are the same. Medical students looking for bodies to work on would stick people with needles full of poison, take them to dissect.
Yeah, and probably it wasn't true.
Yeah.
My guess would be that this is a story that migrated from the rural areas to the city.
Mm-hmm.
And it changed from the night doctors to the needlemen.
Okay.
But it was enough to create a fright, a scare for people. I mean, this is something that you could legitimately be afraid of, you know, that this might happen to you. And whether or not it's true, I don't know, but people swore that it was, you know how that goes.
You were right.
But it's still, It's still a creepy story.
Well, yeah, when you talk about the 1920s and 30s, real scares about needlemen, especially young women in movie theaters or traveling alone. And I was wondering a couple different things about this. One, was it just a scare tactic thing? Two, was it people heard these stories and started pricking women in theaters
and
as
that's
pranks?
Possible too. And you know, this is a story, it's interesting because this particular story, and I did not include it in here because it wasn't set in New Orleans, but when you think of these needleman stories, and you may have read this, I mean, I was really too young to really know too much about it when it was happening. This same story was going around like in the 1980s that there were people who had needles that they were sticking people to give them AIDS.
Yeah,
that was a big AIDS like phobia story.
I didn't know if that was ever true or not.
No, and it's not. But it's the exact same story. So these, just like the night doctors, turning into the needle men, and then years later they've turned into sticking people to give them AIDS. It's the same story, and it just rotates through various generations. You know, that's like the perfect urban legend right there, is that it just keeps going. And that's exactly what happened with this.
Okay.
You know, it metamorphs from, you know, the early 1900s with people getting stuck, you know, to be experimented on, to the 1930s when young women were getting stuck because, well, you shouldn't be going out to the movies at night, and you should be getting home early, and, you know, you might get stuck by one of the needle men, and then you're going to be kidnapped and turned into, you know, a prostitute, and, you know, as they called it, a fate worse than death in the newspapers at the time. But it's pretty much the same story.
Okay, because that was my last question. Was this just a story made up to make women behave?
Yeah, essentially.
Yeah, okay. Well, yeah, that tracks then. Moving on to the next terrible thing. So the gown man, well, okay, not terrible thing, but if it very tall and thin,
the gown man is weird.
Very, very tall and thin, wearing a black cap and black gown, drove a long black automobile, but would also drop from trees, scaring victims. There's a lot of tree dropping.
I know, right?
With these things.
Yeah, I. This is a weird story, and it doesn't. I mean, it doesn't seem to. It makes you think there was someone who played a joke on somebody like this, and it became a thing.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, he cruises around in a black car, and he's wearing these black robes, and it's like, I don't even want to think about that.
No, I don't either.
I really don't. It's,
He's these goth kids, like, that buy a hearse?
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, it's such a weird story, and, you know, it's, you know, every once in a while, do you remember, well, it's pretty much the same story a couple of years ago when it came out.
The clowns?
And people started reporting clowns.
Yeah.
You know, and they were not anything supernatural or anything. It was just some, you know, just
playing pranks.
Jack Watt putting on a clown costume, which I thought was awesome.
Oh,
and
yeah.
I wished I'd have thought of it.
It was great,
you know,
promotion,
and
yeah.
It was, yeah. And this seems like, I mean, it wasn't promoting anything, but it almost seems like somebody just having a good time.
Yeah.
Kind of like the next one, you know, the Huggin' Molly.
This one, so, Huggin' Molly is a little bit sadder.
It's just a sad story.
So, yeah. So wearing a white robe would hide in bushes, jump
which
out.
Which was a bad choice. Well, of outfits,
yes.
The white robe.
And would scoop up women
in a
tight embrace, hug them, and then vanish. And my first thought was like, this is just somebody who wants connection with people, can't get it. That's not the right way to get it, but can't get it.
Right.
And it said, yeah, the story.
And then when you get to the end of the story and you find out where the Huggin' Molly came from,
it was sad. Yeah. And you mentioned also, like you just alluded to it too, you said the Klan had started out as former slave owners who dressed up as ghosts and preyed on free African Americans during
that was initially.
Was that a real thing?
Yes, that was the beginning of the Klan. In the early 1870s was they wanted to intimidate the black population, who at this point had zero education.
Yeah.
They had been working on plantations and now were free. Many of them had nowhere to go. Nobody wanted to hire them. So, but they didn't have any money to go anywhere else. And yet now they had been given the incentive by the government to get out and vote. And, you know, they had been, you know, they're officially citizens now. They're not no longer a three-fifths of a person. And they wanted them to get out and vote. That was the whole idea of Reconstruction, was trying to, you know, build people up to get out and do things on their own. And you had, you know, racists and former plantation owners and Nathan Bedford Forrest and these former Confederate officers who got together and put together the Klan, where they dressed up as ghosts and tried to keep the former slaves from voting, from getting jobs, and really just to scare them as much as possible. And, you know, in a lot of ways it worked, because again, these were people who'd never in their whole life been given any kind of education other than what they'd heard. And what they had heard is a steady diet of ghost stories and, you know, things their whole life.
Yeah.
And so this was terrifying. But, you know, it eventually it died out. But then, of course, it came back big in the 1920s. And
even
you
know, in the 2020s.
Yeah. And now it's never gone away, mm-hmm. unfortunately. But it did come back in the 20s during Prohibition. But at the time, this was not anybody who was talking about seeing somebody running around in white robes. This hadn't been that long since there'd been a Klan. So that scared a lot of people.
Yeah, I'd run too.
And that's where the panic got started. But then, you know, as we find out.
Yeah, it was just a sad man who wanted a hug, but that's not how you get it. Moving on to the next one, the Domino Man. So this initially made me want pizza, but I was like, this, to be fair,
wrong kind of Domino.
So does everything. Yeah. So 1930 began haunting the Jaunty neighborhood, is that how you pronounce
it? Yeah, Jaunty.
Jaunty,
yeah.
Okay. Yeah. In those days, the middle-class neighborhood around the lake...
Pontchartrain.
Okay. Yeah. And Bayou, St. John, was sparsely populated, had a lot of woods, empty lots. Children used to use these paths to get to school. And they claimed a man in a white robe and hood would jump down from the tree branches and chase them with his hands waving wildly over his head. He never physically hurt them, and he was never caught. This reminds me of, like, the wacky waving inflatable tube man
thing.
Yeah,
right, exactly. I mean, I don't know what the purpose here was other than this guy just... For fun.
I would love to prank the fuck
just
out
wanted,
of some little
well,
kids.
Well, and that's what this seems like. And, you know, he looked like, a costume looked like it had been made out of sugar bags.
Yeah,
that's
right,
why they
right.
call him the Domino Man.
Right.
Because the refinery, like, the Jaunty neighborhood is here, and Lower Ninth Ward is right next to it.
Okay.
And that's right on the other side of that is where the Domino Sugar refinery was. And a lot of people from this neighborhood worked there. So when they saw this guy in this costume, and I'd say there's a good chance that's where the costume came from.
Uh-huh.
Cotton sugar. And flour and things used to come in a canvas bag. You've probably seen them
in
antique stores and stuff. You know, the big cotton bag. So this guy had this costume, and he just would scare the hell out of kids who were walking through the woods on their way to school. And you know, nobody ever found him. Nobody ever caught him. You know, they claim they shot at him. So. That's when your prank gets a little too serious,
yes.
I think, when someone starts shooting at you.
Oh, I can imagine. You're going to see me in like 2 weeks just drunk, dressed in Domino's pizza boxes, chasing little kids until
I
get
shot.
In
like a robot outfit,
yes.
You know, made out of Domino boxes.
Yeah, Domino Pizzatron.
Let me know how that goes.
If I get shot, we'll know.
Yeah.
All right, moving on. Let's go to an even more serious
story.
So Chateau Le Moyne Hotel, is that how you pronounce it?
Yes.
In 1998.
This is a rather grim episode. I don't know if you've noticed that.
Well,
the first one had a little bit of fun to it.
It wasn't.
And then it just stops being fun.
It wasn't as bad in my head because we were talking about it beforehand, and I was like, I don't think all these stories are that bad. And I was trying to work my way through them, and I'm like, oh, you know, okay.
Yeah, they're pretty bad.
Yeah. I think the most tame one is just scaring little kids or maybe a hug. But now let's get even more serious. So, 1998, a maid finds a naked man, aside from his socks, dead on the floor of a hotel room, and there's just blood everywhere, sex toys everywhere. Eventually, it's ruled that he'd been stabbed to death. His name was Ramon Martinez, and he was a Catholic priest.
Yeah.
Which
is problematic.
Problematic for a few reasons, yeah. And he's initially an actor who actually landed some roles in things, some shows I'd heard of.
I know it. And it kind of made me see if I could figure out what episodes he was in.
I thought about Googling it, but I just didn't.
But I don't know if I want to subject myself to Three's Company and Different Strokes, to be honest with you. So
I thought Three's Company was fun.
So. It's all right.
Yeah.
It is what it is. Certainly not a show you could make now.
Oh, no. But at some point on what I'm guessing March 23rd, since they found him on the 24th. So March 23rd, I'm guessing he picks up Robert Chidester, who claims it was self-defense when we get to it later, which is a little excessive.
Yeah.
Police find a bunch of porn in the rectory, which I'm like, come on.
That's an issue too.
Yes, that
in my opinion.
And that is and that is an issue. And we could go into
300 pornographic.
Okay.
Well, remember,
it
was the late 80s and everything was available. There was no online porn back then. So if you wanted porn, you had to buy magazines or videotape, VHS tapes. And this guy had a hell of a collection, I guess, for the time.
Right.
And for the subject matter.
Yes.
Because honestly, let me give you a little bit of you know,
into the catalog, or what are we
doing? I want to give you a little an idea of how much money he had invested in this. Back in 1989, you couldn't just go out and buy a movie for $20. When you bought a videotape, now, because let's be honest, the porn industry really caused the creation of the home video. I mean, I could give you
what's the Criterion disc versus whatever?
Well, they are the ones who pushed us into videotapes,
right,
because
the
movie studios, the big studios, you know, 20th Century Fox, Warner Brothers, they didn't want videotapes. In fact, they did everything they could to fight it because they wanted people to have to go to the theater. They didn't want stuff to be available to be watched at home. But, I mean, no one wants to go sit in a grungy, sticky movie theater to watch porn.
You had to say sticky.
So they wanted it at home. So they, between the porn industry and the mob, who had the biggest investment in it, they're the ones who really got started with home video. So we every time you watch a movie at home, if you own a – well, nobody owns a VHS player anymore, very many people. But if you watch – say you watch a movie on DVD, and some of you still own DVD players. I still have one. I just don't watch it much. But,
same.
You know, it's you owe that to the porn industry and the mob, honestly, because they're the ones who pushed for it. So – anyway, my point is that in the late 80s, you could not just go out and buy stuff for $20. You had to wait months and months and months before you might get some stuff at an affordable price. Usually, you just had to rent videotapes, because to buy a single videotape in the 80s, they were like $80, $90.
Mm.
So let's say you wanted E.T., we won't do any porn stuff. We'll go with E.T. You wanted a copy of E.T. on videotape, and if you wanted to buy that, it might cost you $80 or $90. But that's why they would have a – that's why the video industry was so big, because they would buy, you know, 50 tapes at $90 a pop so that people could – that was the suggested retail price. So this guy with 300 – okay – 300 pornographic films. I mean, this dude has got, I mean, this is
it's
like
a lot of money.
This is like 10 or 12 grand
worth
of pornos in his rectory, in his Catholic Church rectory, not to mention all the magazines and books.
I just don't like
the
kink shame.
I mean, so we're talking about thousands. I know, but we're talking. No, I'm not either. All I'm
know,
saying is
I
this
know.
Dude.
It's a serious
this
investment.
Dude had thousands of dollars invested in his collection.
Right.
And so he would, you know, then drive into the city where he could, you know, meet somebody that he could act out the movies he was watching, I guess. But, you know, the 80s, the French Quarter in the 80s was a whole different place than it is
I
now,
bet.
Let me tell you.
I bet.
It was definitely a different place than it is now. So just putting that out there.
I get it. Yeah. No, he had a lot invested in this. We owe a lot to the porn industry. So whenever you click on those online videos, let the pre-roll ad roll all the way out. Give them your 2 cents before you move on. I think the whole reason I brought that up was that I was thinking of that. What was that latest?
I just gave everybody a history of the
I love
VHS
it.
Tape history that no one wanted.
No. We all wanted it.
I'm sorry. Just trying to make a point.
Of course.
A lot of dough.
What was the latest Clint Eastwood movie that Richard, the guy with the bomb? I can't remember.
Richard Jewell.
Yeah, Richard Jewell. Yeah. Because they found a bunch of porn in his room in his mom's house, and they tried to like use that against him. And it's like, the guy lives in his mom's house.
Yeah, he lives in his mom's basement. Of course, he watches porn.
Like, that should be irrelevant to like that. And that's just kind of what I wanted to point.
It's a standard.
Yeah, that's what I wanted to point out here.
Okay, but this guy had other issues.
I know. Yeah. I know.
I'm not even talking about the priest. I'm talking about the guy he picked up. This was a scumbag.
Like that he's a murderer?
No. Yeah. These are the people that I point out to you when we, first time you and I went to New Orleans. I pointed out to you, and I said, they look like they're begging, but they're not.
Uh-huh.
You need to stay away from those people. Do you remember that?
I do. Yes, yes.
This is one of those guys.
Okay, good to know. Good to know. I was going to pick that guy up, too. I'm really glad. That,
well, I didn't mean that.
I just meant
don't even give him money.
Right.
So.
No, I get it. Yeah. So, okay, this guy, Richard Chidester. So he
does this terrible thing, kills this guy, and he immediately flees.
Stabs him 40 times.
40 fucking
in
times.
In self-defense.
And of course, you know, yeah. He's got to really make sure. Flees to Cincinnati right after the murder. He did a really good job blending in, is that what you said? Or did he eventually yeah, cross right. into Kentucky and stab someone
else?
But he gets away with it yeah. because most likely it was another male-in-male
Some
encounter.
Some guy he picked up.
Didn't want to.
Yeah.
Didn't want to be caught. Eventually gets confident enough, goes back to New Orleans, hooks up with a tarot card reader whom he tells, hey, you know, I killed a priest. And
now, shouldn't she have known that ahead of time?
She should have known that. And I'm surprised she didn't play into that.
I was going to put that in there. I could figure out how to work that in.
Right,
but yeah.
Right.
Hey, at least she turned him in.
At least she turns. So yeah, immediately yeah. turns him in. In his confession, this is metal, he said he claimed to be the angel of death sent to punish right. the wicked priest.
Right.
Okay, you mentioned also most of the sex stuff was like kept out of the papers.
It was.
So how did you, where did it come out?
Later it came out.
Okay.
At the time,
okay.
they were kind of keeping that kind of quiet.
Just because of the church
it
and
was,
stuff?
Well, and you also, the other thing is go back and look at what the murder rate was in New Orleans in the late mm-hmm. 80s. It was, I believe this was at the time in the late 80s that this was the number one murder capital in the United States.
Damn.
It was New Orleans. New Orleans was a much different place in the 80s than it is now. I mean, that I can remember going down there then, and you didn't leave your hotel. You kept your wallet in your front pocket because mm-hmm. you didn't take any side streets. If it wasn't well lit, you didn't leave bourbon. I mean, it was,
it was a
different place. And they were, you know, suddenly now they've got all these murders they're dealing with anyway. And now we've got a priest involved, and you know it's a very Catholic town, and mm-hmm. this, you know, and they just didn't want that splashed everywhere. And as it worked out, they got him to confess, and that kind of kept things quiet.
And that means he's probably out on the streets
25
now.
Years, which means he probably served what maybe 15, if that.
Lawyer, how many?
Yeah, we'll ask Kaylin. She's here. She's our
resident
attorney.
Counsel.
And he probably served what, like 15, probably.
Yeah, unhinged.
Well,
yeah, maybe he got killed in prison.
Well, I don't know. I couldn't find any record of him. I don't know what happened to him. So, yeah.
About that.
So
cool.
Yeah. So theoretically, he got out. Like
maybe we saw him
10 or 15 years ago. So he's either floating around there somewhere, or
he's
got
to be dead
so,
by now.
Probably listening to this episode.
Oh shit. Okay. Well, don't call. Don't email us.
Let me give you Cody's address.
Oh boy.
I'm just kidding.
Troy doesn't even know my address. Well, actually, he might. I don't know.
Actually, I do.
Damn
so.
It. Okay. On the last story. So this is Dr. Etienne Deschamps, and
yes.
I only know Etienne because that was my French name in French class.
Really?
And it translates to Stephen, if I'm remembering
really?
Correctly.
No,
yeah,
I didn't know that.
Which I didn't know at the time when
well,
I picked it.
Well, as we've already discussed and as people have criticized us, I don't know shit about French.
I took 3 years
sorry,
of it.
I'm sorry,
I
did not take it at all. If it was all Spanish, I'd be fine. But,
yeah, we try.
I don't know much about French, but I've done my best. And listen, I spent a lot of time.
You do phonetically spell things out
well,
for me.
I do, and then I also spent a lot of time on, like, pronunciation websites,
mm-hmm.
many of which are wrong.
Yeah, I know.
So
and how
and
do you
then
know?
I find out that they're really wrong, and I'm like, okay, that is, I know that's not right.
Yeah.
So you got to keep searching. So I do the best I can. I don't speak French, but I actually do, for those of you who have written in shitty reviews about how, you know, we've butchered French,
mm-hmm.
I apologize for that before we even started the season.
That is true.
So, you know, I'm sorry. Again, I'm sorry, but I've done the best that I can.
Yep.
And I do research it as far as I can.
That's
so,
why I wake up every
yes.
morning just saying, hey, I'm just going to apologize in advance. And I just, that's a blanket
yeah.
statement.
That's just my life story right there. I apologize in advance, age two.
So let's talk about Dr. Etienne and his magnetism.
Oh, man.
So and one of the other ones, this was a bogus science I wasn't even aware of.
I knew a little bit about it because I knew about like mesmerism, which is kind
uh-huh.
of a next step over. But this was... this was definitely interesting. But as I pointed out, though, that, you know, when you consider crystals, oils, magnetic bracelets, all these things, it's really not that much
it's
different
not that
than,
much different.
Than magnetism, believing that it can cure everything. And,
You know, it reminds me when we were at the Mineral Springs in Alton, and I'm talking about, you know, all the things they claimed that the water would cure in those days before, you know, the FDA set limits on what you could claim.
Right.
Or, you know, that your silver oxide stuff cures the coronavirus. Or my favorite is that my church has ionization, so it just wipes out the virus. It's like, oh my God, how
no, you're fine.
On television saying this? It can't even pronounce ionization
right.
for one thing, but... Okay, what? Nope. Wrong podcast.
You're right.
Sorry, wrong podcast.
Like you said, let Darwin take care of it. But yes. Boasted about how magnetism could treat any ailment from alcoholism to erectile dysfunction and even provide psychic powers. So I'm just saying, back in the day, you would have had my attention, right?
Yeah, well.
That would have been like, all right, let's talk. So he's convinced he could use these powers to also locate Jean Lafitte's lost treasure, if you remember from our
early
episodes.
Had to bring that
episodes.
Up because Jean Lafitte has been in several episodes of this season.
It's probably one of my favorite people from this whole season that I've learned about.
Right.
Favorite people is a loose term, but so
at least he was honest about what he was doing. I'm a pirate and I'm not telling you otherwise.
Well, it's very Jack Sparrow where he says, like, a dishonest man you can always trust to, like, be dishonest.
That's
you know
right.
it's the
that's
honest
right.
ones you got to watch out for.
Mm-hmm.
And that's very true. So he's convinced he can find this lost treasure, but here's the kicker, Troy. He needed a medium, specifically a 12-year-old virgin, which one of his clients just happened to have
a daughter.
Yeah, so but he also, yet again, another kicker, needs to douse the daughter with large amounts of chloroform and climb into bed with her, and both of them have to be naked.
Right.
So this guy makes my fucking skin crawl more so than the guy who stabs somebody else 40 times.
I know, right?
Finally, he does this shit for a while. Finally, ends up killing her when he realizes you overdose. You just get poisoned. I mean,
chloroform. I mean, it's like any other drug. I mean, essentially, it's like when you go to the hospital for a surgery and they inject you with
anesthesia or
something to put you out. It's an anesthetic,
mm-hmm.
But it was fairly new at the time. But it's still like ether.
Mm-hmm.
Ether came first, chloroform, I believe, was second. But anytime you ever hear about back in the, you know, the teens and 20s and 30s, you know, all the gangster stories, they would chloroform people. They
put
it on a rag and put it over your face
right.
and then throw you in the trunk of a car and then you go on a one-way ride.
Yeah.
But this was essentially him using a cloth over her face. And I didn't include this into the story, but when they found her body, she had been burned across her mouth and nose because of the... you know, the chemical reaction to it but when he killed her. But I thought that was enough. The story enough, with everything that went wrong here.
That's
so,
enough. So yeah. he finally ends up killing her. When he realizes he's killed her, he decides to do the noble thing and tries to stab himself in the chest four times.
Half-heartedly, so to speak.
So to speak.
It's a pandemic.
God damn it, pandemic. I love it, though. You know what? I'm kind of glad he didn't die then. Because then he survives long enough to go to trial, and he's found guilty in 18 minutes of deliberation, and he appeals, gets a new trial, and this time it only took 13 minutes. And before he can be executed, this is one of the weird things, Judge Robert Marr, who presided over both trials, goes to vote, walks by the river, disappears?
They just never found him.
What do you think, he skipped town? Do you think he fell in?
No one knows. I mean, that's the thing. They tried. They thought maybe they should drag the river.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they never found him. I guess it became part of this story because he was so adamant. I mean, he was the judge in both of his trials.
He was adamant
that he's not crazy. And he was the one who pushed for him to be executed after murdering a 12-year-old girl. And so he was really an integral part of his criminal case. And then while he's waiting for his execution date, he just vanishes. The judge just vanishes.
Yeah.
And it became a big story at the time. And I thought that it was definitely worthwhile to mention.
Right. Well, I'm glad that even though he disappeared, it didn't matter. And Etienne still hangs and then gets, would you say, tossed in a murderer's grave, killer's grave?
Yeah, an unmarked grave.
But
the other interesting thing about this, and I didn't, you know, sometimes you have to leave things out because there's just no way to work them into the story. When they took his body down after he had hanged, they actually cut open his skull to examine his brain to see if it was deformed in some way that would explain why he was a murderer, but they couldn't find anything wrong with it.
So, yeah, maybe they could today. Who knows?
Who knows? Or probably not, because that's about as legitimate of science as taking photographs of a dead person's eyes and thinking that the killer is going to show up on their eyelids in the photo. It's not really. There's really no way to know.
No, I was thinking,
you know, they did that. They do that with a lot of. They've done it with. At the time, say 1940, they used to cut out people's brains all the time
to see, you know, if like there's something different.
They cut open Dillinger's brain and then kept cutting it open and then kept losing pieces of it. And eventually, there were so many pieces of Dillinger's brain that were lost. They kept saying how many pieces they had. It was actually more than the brain that he had that was lost. They also used to claim that, maybe I shouldn't add this. They used to claim that they had the Smithsonian had Dillinger's penis in a jar because it was so big.
He's packing.
But that's not a true story. That got started because there's this one photograph that you see where they've got a body on display at the morgue. I mean, obviously it's not Dillinger because Dillinger got away anyway, but it's his double. Okay. It's Jimmy Lawrence there in the morgue. And he's got his elbow turned. And he's stiffened that way, and it looks like he's got like a tent in the sheet that's like 18 inches high. And so this story got started that, you know, about this, and it's not true. So if you ever hear that Dillinger's penis is in a jar at the Smithsonian, it's really not. Neither is Jimmy Lawrence's either, but still. So,
I don't know, to rob a bunch of banks, you got at least that big balls,
that's
right?
That's right. Especially the way he did it.
I'm just saying. Yeah. Anyway, I don't even remember
how did we get onto that? Oh, his brain. I told you about
the brain. Oh, I was thinking.
They cut open the doctor's
head, I was thinking, check his brain. The guy, I can't remember his name, but who I believe was on a campus or something and went up and shot a bunch of people and wrote
Charles
him,
Whitman.
Yeah, and was like, he's like, something's wrong with my brain, check it out. And there was like a tumor or something.
Right. And that does happen.
That's what I was thinking, not like it's misshapen or
whatever. Well, he was, I mean, this guy from our story was, I mean, he'd been a con artist most of his life. I think Charles Whitman is one of those, that's why he was so scary, is because he just was this all-American guy. He'd been a Marine, and so, and he just snapped one day and went up onto a tower, started shooting people, not because he was just this evil person, but obviously something had happened. And
right.
Like you said, turns out he had a brain tumor. But, you know, since that time, you know, he set the trend for more of this. Not that there have been plenty of, and that's the thing. You know, we talk about these shootings and school shootings. Listen, this, all you got to do is study history. This stuff's been going on forever.
Yeah.
And there were big shootings in the early 1900s. I mean, there's that guy, I wrote about that guy in Suffer the Children that blew up that school with all those kids in it because he didn't want to pay his property taxes. Jeez. Guy's a nutcase.
Right.
You know, and that was in the early 1900s. I mean, so this stuff's been around. People have been deranged forever, you know. It's just 24-hour news cycle, we see a lot more of it. You
That's
know?
True.
But he was a shocking dude in the 1960s. It was not something that people had seen. Although, 3 years after JFK? So, I don't know. This country's a mess. The whole world's a mess.
Yeah. And on that note, it is now time for our Ghostwriter segment. Yeah. If you have a question or comment about the world of the macabre, you can email us at AmericanHauntingsPodcast@gmail.com. Our first email comes to us from Veronica, and she says, I just started listening to your podcast.
It's an Elvis Costello song. Sorry.
Sure. No, you're fine. That's right.
I was going to sing it, but
please don't. I just started listening to your podcast in this quarantine life. I searched for numerous podcasts involving hauntings and stumbled upon this one. I love the history lesson that and the hauntings that go with it, so keep up the good work. Thank you very much for that, Veronica. And this last one is from Bindi. It's really long, so I'm not going to read the whole thing, but basically says, I just found your podcast. I was so excited.
Basically says, you suck.
You suck. No. She says, I'm so excited to find something professional and good about our area.
Okay, well, professional. Let's not get carried away. I appreciate you saying that, but let's not get carried away.
Yeah, it's just flattering us. I live in St. Charles, a transplant from Michigan. My parents are both born and raised in St. Louis. Originally, before moving here, regular visits for family functions always made me curious about the histories and many of the historical sites in the area, especially the paranormal histories. Keeps going on to say her first job was working for Augie Bush back in 1978. She basically offers, if we ever need anything, any help with anything, she's always there to help us out. And so I just want to say thank you and just really appreciate that. That's all I got, man.
Cool.
I'm done.
No, that's good. I think we're good.
All right, bye.
Yep, that's it. All right, no more signing off. No, I'm just kidding. So, well, anyway, guys, thank you very much for listening. Thank you for sticking with us from the before times to the now times.
Damn it.
No, really, seriously, it's been fun for us to come up with new ways to how we were going to figure out how we're going to do this podcast when we were completely isolated.
Yeah.
So now we're not as isolated. So it's been good for us, and hopefully it would be good for you guys too. Just stay safe out there. Keep telling everybody. I know that things are starting to open up. They're getting better, but don't be stupid. You know, wash your hands, social distance, wear the freaking mask.
I got one in my pocket.
It sucks.
Just fucking wear
I know it.
It
sucks, but when you go to the grocery store, I mean, let's be honest, you go to Walmart, I want to wear a hazmat suit, and that was in the before times, let alone now.
Time.
So why not a mask? So anyway, guys, just be careful out there. We definitely don't want to lose any of our listeners because we cannot afford to lose anyone. So we need you. So share it with your friends, review us on iTunes, or, you know, send us an email, whatever you want to do. We will see you as things start to open up this summer and into the fall. And, you know, hopefully next year will be a whole different year and we will not be sitting around doing a podcast when we're supposed to be doing the conference instead. So anyway, thanks again, guys, and take care. So long, and see you later.
No, I really think that since it's the aftertimes, we need to change things. And
I think we'll just end right there.
So we just end right there. And we end with this episode of the American Hauntings Podcast. Was written by Troy Taylor and is produced and edited by me, Cody Beck. And each bi-weekly episode, this is always going to happen, we try to combine history, folklore, legend, imagination, and the truth to reveal more about America's most haunted places, strange tales, and unexplained events. You can find the show on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you find your favorite shows, and at AmericanHauntingsPodcast.com, where we have show notes, more info about the episodes, and links to more from American Hauntings. Because American Hauntings isn't just a podcast.
Are you planning on updating?
It's books, tours, events, and more.
Just hang on.
Are
you going to change the website when we were talking about in between seasons?
What?
You talked about, well, we just updated the website. Were you going to change it again between seasons? I don't think you should. I like it how it is now.
Was I going to do that?
Well, I don't know, but we just updated it not very long ago.
Yeah, well, I wanted to change other things.
But we're not going to change the way that we did the episodes, right?
No, no.
Okay, good.
No, I'll keep doing that.
Well, we were just talking before, and I just reminded me.
No, this is a good time to do this instead of before or after. And if you want even more from us, you can be a supporter of this the podcast, damn it, on Patreon. You can get bonus episodes of the show, t-shirts, discounts, great stuff in the mail, and more. Thanks to our supporters, we have upgraded our equipment. Maybe
because
I did
American Hauntings
for this
isn't
show.
Just a podcast, it's books, tours, events, and our main website is at AmericanHauntings.net.
I
think you skipped
I was interrupted mid-sentence. AmericanHauntings.net. Anyway, we can, with more help from you, we can dedicate more time and resources to creating even more shows in the future, more jokes and shit. Take a minute and check it out. We think you like what you find at patreon.com/AmericanHauntings. Be sure to get in touch if you have any comments about the show.
I had comments, and you complained.
Suggestions, reviews. You have to use the same form that everybody else
does.
Email me.
I need to email you
and
any
get comments to it in a month. I'll get to it in a month. If you just want to tell us what you really think of us, we're reachable via email, on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, by Carrier Pigeon.
And a Candygram.
Candygram.
Yep.
That's Telegram. A nice one.
Plumber.
Land shark. Until next time, goodbye.
So long. See you later.
See you later.
Ugh. I'm often desperately trying to come up with something that I can interrupt you with. Now I've just found out.